All right, thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, January 30th, and sunny skies, a little less sunnier than they were, a little less sunny, I should say, than they were a few minutes ago. The clouds are coming in, but still not too bad. It's still up there. It's Monday, and on Mondays we talk to the folks from Chicago Inno. Jim Dahlke is here. Will Flanagan, the general manager, usually in the seat, has relinquished it to Karis Husted. Karis, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And so Karis is here, Dahlke is here, and one of the things that we've talked about a lot is the immigration, really, and reliance on immigrants when it comes to the tech world in not just Chicago, but in the country. So when I knew you guys were going to come in today, I kind of wanted to address that and to see how the weekend and the temporary ban and all that is impacting the tech world in Chicago.
Yeah, tech companies both in Chicago and nationally rely on immigrants to staff their companies. It is a huge source of talent from all over the world in tech jobs. And really what we saw this weekend was the tech community nationally really find its voice opposing Trump for the first time. I think what we kind of saw, especially from some of the big Silicon Valley players, is that they are willing to go along with Trump and willing to work with him. When you saw them all sit at the table with him, I mean, you saw Cook and Sheryl Sandberg at Facebook, and everybody sort of gather around and sort of willing to work with him. And this is really the first time that we saw some real pushback from some of his specific measures.
Well, what will, I mean, you say that it depends on the immigrants. What will this temporary ban mean for these companies? I mean, is it just going to slow them down? Are people going to stop coming to this country? Or what's the impact?
Well, I think this impact is probably relatively small in the huge grand scheme of things, but it is certainly a first step that a lot of companies are saying, whoa, this is not a direction that we want to go in. We have employees who are from these countries. We have employees who have families who are from these countries. And the last thing that we want to do is sort of disrupt their ability to go home or their family to come here and visit them.
You've been talking to some companies?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is also certainly impacting companies that are here in Chicago as well. We saw a lot of talk on social media over the weekend, including founders such as Shraddha Agarwal, who's co-founder of Outcome Health, which was formerly Context Media. She is an immigrant, and she talked about how she employs over 600 people here in Illinois. She's been here for 12 years, and she has not been able to become a citizen yet. So, you know, that's one example of a founder who, you know, is an immigrant and has still been able to be here and become a very successful founder.
Right. And does she feel at risk, do you think?
So she does not personally feel at risk, but, you know, she said her heart aches for those detained despite legal status. I think that was a big issue as well, is that there was confusion over the weekend as to whether people with green cards could be allowed in or not. And it's still sort of on a case by case waiver, case by case. So I think that's going to be kind of an issue moving forward, is what do you do even for those people who have a green card?
And I think you're seeing companies put their money where their mouth is, too. I mean, Airbnb, for example, is putting up refugees who are barred from getting to the U.S. They're putting up free housing for them in their country.
Oh, so, no kidding. I hadn't seen that.
Yeah. So, yeah, Airbnb is sort of doing that. I mean, that's money coming out of their pocket. Lyft is pledging to donate up $1 million over the next 4 years to the ACLU. Google is putting together a $4 million crisis campaign to donate to the ACLU and a bunch of other immigrant legal resource organizations.
Isn't Starbucks hiring?
Yeah, I think they said 10,000.
Yep, 10,000. And then here in Chicago, Jason Fried, who's the founder of Basecamp, is donating $2,000 to it, an organization supporting refugees as well.
And so we've got all that. We've got all the bluster and the efforts to alleviate any immediate pain. But I just wonder if we go back to these people in Iran or wherever, that they are finding their place to go and innovate in 5 years from now or 4 years from now. Are those people who we depend on and who we need to grow and create, are they more likely to go somewhere else in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's like the biggest part of this ban that a lot of people are talking about, is that some people say, oh, it's just 100, just 200 people. But you have to think about what that implies, what that actually means for America's brand, per se, of innovation and startups. Right now, 51% of the unicorns in the United States, so startups valued at $1 billion, have a foreign-born founder. So, I mean,
Say that again, Karis.
51% of the unicorns, so that startups valued at $1 billion or more in the United States, have a foreign-born founder. So, I mean, these are drivers of jobs, job growth, job creation, which actually has a lot of implication for American citizens as well. And so it's sort of like, so what if one of those 100 turned away would have been the founder of the next Uber, the next Google?
Interesting way to frame it, because Donald Trump calls himself the jobs president, and he may in some ways be stifling jobs by trying to increase border security.
Canada already seeing an uptick in tech workers. From
Tell
people.
Me that, it, really?
Yeah, Canada's just over the weekend, they had a report out that said that, yeah, Canada's seeing an uptick in its tech pipeline. So, hey, people who want to work in thriving tech companies are going to go somewhere. If they can't go to the U.S., they'll look elsewhere.
Jim Dahlke and Kyrus Husted in the studio. They're from Chicago Inno. Come by most Mondays. We're going to take a break. Just so you know our plans for the day, it looks like, and it's never a hard start time, but it looks like the White House press briefing will start at around 12:30 or so. And because of this pressing issue and the president also signing an executive order about business regulation today, we're going to carry that press briefing, at least at the beginning of it, when it starts. Maybe 12:30, maybe a little bit after that. But we're going to take a break, come back, and talk about dementia and startups in Chicago. It's 12:23, the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here on this Monday afternoon, and glad you're there. Thanks very much for tuning in. Jim Dahlke and Kyrus Husted from Chicago Inno are in the studio. And, one of the stories I wanted to talk about that I saw recently at Chicago Inno is this. It's all about data, right? Collecting data to do research and more medical research, and now they're focusing on dementia.
Yeah, absolutely. So a new startup that has recently launched in Chicago is called NeuroCERN. And basically what they're trying to use data and algorithms to tackle is how to better care for dementia patients.
So what does that mean?
Right. So basically dementia is a very nuanced disease. And right now we don't have a cure for it. And so the most important thing is making sure there are the correct caregiving for that person's specific kind of dementia. So what they do is a knowledgeable caregiver will answer a series of questions about a patient's symptoms. And then that will go into the NeuroCERN system, and they'll actually use their proprietary algorithm and analytics to provide a very personalized care plan for that patient.
Interesting that you use the word personalized, and persons really aren't involved that much at all.
Well, in a way, but the most important thing is that this is coming from a knowledgeable caregiver. So a lot of the times, you know, family members who might not have any medical training at all are the ones who have to deal with how to care for someone who has a very complicated disease. And also oftentimes the patient can't really vocalize that fully because, you know, they're having mental issues, problem speaking. And so this sort of takes that issue and uses algorithms and analytics to solve it.
In Carissa's lead paragraph, she's got some interesting statistics here. 47.5 million people have dementia worldwide. That's expected to triple by 2050. Mm-hmm. Now, you write that the numbers of dementia have actually been decreasing in the U.S., mm-hmm. but the numbers of old people's going up.
Right. So it's basically staying the same.
Right. So the ratio might be going down a little bit. The number of patients is pretty static.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting, too, about that number of the number of cases that's increasing, it's increasing a lot in lower income and middle income classes, or the lower and middle income people. And those are the people who are the least likely to have access to, say, personalized care or really in-depth diagnosis.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting trend that we're seeing. I mean, it's an odd sort of topic to tackle as a young entrepreneur, but we had a conversation at one of our events not too long ago with the Dorm Room Fund, and they go all across the country and fund young entrepreneurs, and they're seeing a huge uptick in elder care startups.
Really?
So basically startups that are tackling problems for older people. And what they're seeing, I mean, you see a lot of entrepreneurs that tackle issues that are relevant to their life. I mean, they're seeing their grandparents go through this issue. How can I sort of develop technology to make the life better for my grandparents?
It reminds me of, didn't we see Joe Biden talking about this sort of database when it comes to cancer research, right? And is this a similar sort of thing?
Exactly. I mean, I think what you're just seeing is that we've got so much data and we're building so much technology, and it's a lot of it's for our millennial lives. You know, how do I get in a cab faster? You know,
right.
But I think what we're realizing that there is a huge world of problems that we can tackle that we haven't even really been thinking about before, and we're starting to see that with kind of this elder care sort of population.
All right, so that's that, and if people are interested because of relatives or one thing or another, I mean, this is still in the early stages, right? It's not usable?
Yeah, it's still in the early stages. They're doing pilot programs right now with community hospitals, basically to see how this does work for, I think they're doing it with a nurse practitioner. So this is someone who doesn't have expertise in dementia, but is really interested in working with the patients who have dementia. So they have a pilot program and should be rolling out
soon. And not that it's the only cost. I mean, obviously there's other costs involved with the healthcare of this patient, but it seems like it would be a cost cutter in a way that you'd enter your numbers into a machine and out comes a sort of strategy.
Well, yeah.
I'm simplifying it, but
sure. Well, but it's like a supply and demand issue. As you can see, the number of cases of dementia are increasing every day, but the number of people in the United States that has actually dementia, doctors that have a focus on dementia is only about 600. And so the people who have that expertise are very low. So potentially using an algorithm in analytics, you know, you can put that program out anywhere in the world. So it's kind of addressing, I think, the supply and demand issue.
That's Karis Husted, Jim Dahlke as well from Chicago Inno. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Great to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, we're standing by for the White House press briefing. It could be interesting today given the weekend's events at the airports and the ban on some passengers coming into the U.S., some of those detained for a number of hours. So we're standing by to take that live when we can. Expect that soon. But I want to talk about a study that was released at the Urban League earlier today. It comes out of the Alternative Schools Network. And let me read a sentence from the Chicago Tribune. Of the city's 77 community areas, so think neighborhoods, just five accounted for a third of the homicides last year. And those same five had jobless rates ranging from 79% to 92% for teenagers, 49% to 70% for young adults. There are not jobs there. There is violence. Jack West is one of the people behind the study, and he joins us now on a phone line. Jack, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
So I just gave those startling numbers. I think, I don't know if people realize that. And then I think some of us might think a little too quickly, well, they should go out and get a job. But the idea is that maybe there aren't jobs there to be had.
That's exactly right. And what the study showed, why the great Cities Institute, University of Illinois, showed it, just an evacuation of jobs from 1960 to the present, particularly in the West and South sides. The way to stop this violence is to provide many jobs for any kid who wants a job and combine it with education, because a lot of the kids are out of school, they've dropped out of school, they want to get something, but they see no hope. We can stop this violence with jobs. There used to be a federal summer jobs program until 2000. It used to employ over 600,000 low-income kids. Since then, all those kids were fired. They have no jobs. They have no experience. Kids in middle-class families and middle-class neighborhoods and upper-class neighborhoods, they all have jobs. They have the experience. The kids in the inner city, there are no jobs, and they don't have the experience, so they turn to violence and they turn to drugs. And
Jack, let me interrupt you, though. The kids on the northwest side, they've got jobs. The kids on the west side don't necessarily. Is that because, I mean, the kids on the northwest side are traveling downtown for jobs, or there's just more economic activity where they live?
There's just more economic activity. I mean, and you go out to Wheeling, Northbrook, I mean, there's jobs everywhere. Kids can get jobs out there. There are no jobs in the inner city to speak of, and the kids oftentimes don't even leave their neighborhoods.
I don't mean to keep interrupting you. I got a lot of ground I want to cover, though. I'm sorry.
Sure.
I'm interested in reading about the fact, you know, the jobs are one thing, the money is one thing, but there also are skills involved with obtaining a job. And if there aren't a job, there aren't jobs to even interview for, the kids don't develop the skills that they'll need down the road to get higher paying jobs.
Absolutely. And again, you learn how to get along with people, not to tell your employer to bug off, you know, how to follow instructions, how to show up on time, and you get the satisfaction of getting money and paid like everybody does. Those are the things that kids desperately need on the West and South sides. They got them with the old federal jobs program. A kid might come in at 16 and screw around, but they knew the community-based organization they were working through. At 17, 18, they start to mature. They learn those skills. Like you're saying, it's not just technical skills. It's just those skills of getting along, showing up on time. And then they're good prospects to maybe find jobs out further away from where they live. But the problem is they don't have those initial jobs in their neighborhood.
I read about Whole Foods opening up or, you know, Chipotle or things like that. I mean, those are little things, but do you see any sort of institutional drive to create opportunities in these neighborhoods?
There's very little. The mayor's trying to do what he can. But again, the government has to be the first employer for these kids. It was up until 2000. It was a huge mistake to stop that. The violence is directly towards kids who would have nothing else to do.
When you say the government, when you say the government has to be the first employer,
federal government,
what do you mean by that?
I mean they provide money for jobs through that would come through the city and then smaller community-based organizations, faith-based organizations that know the kids, can reach out to them and get them in line in a job.
And that's that went away, you said, when, 2010?
2000.
2000, okay.
It was a terrible mistake.
Well, the president says he wants to get the feds involved. Do you think that's what he's talking about?
I know. I hope so. I mean, he wants to do the infrastructure and employ a lot of men who have been laid off of work and sort of given up. We've got lots of kids in the same way. And the business is facing a real labor shortage. And if we don't train these kids on the first jobs, and then they can get the skills of how to show up and do skill training, businesses are going to be even more strapped to find workers. There was a big article in Cranes on Amazon having a hard time finding employees for their fulfillment centers in Pennsylvania, and they're going to have the same problem in Illinois and other states.
Tell me also about movements, and I know that there have been some easings of restrictions about prohibitions on people with a record getting a job. It's easier now for kids who did something stupid or a few things stupid when they were younger to be employed. But I know that's one of your recommendations as well, right? We've got to not write kids off because of things they did when they were 14 and 15 years old.
Absolutely. Absolutely.